confetti of the Old Testament.
That's right. All right, Exodus chapter 24. One of the things that we need to talk about before we even read the scripture is, you know, we need to just remind ourselves and set the scene. Where are we? You know, what and what's been happening so far? We've been studying, in particular, you know, Exodus 21 through 23, but really since chapter 19, you know, we're at Mount Sinai. And somehow we have to get God's people in tune to where they can have what is about to happen in 24, a meal together. Okay? I think that's an interesting way to look at it. It's obviously the culmination of the Sinai scene, as Heiser puts it, that we began back in chapter 19. He says this, we get the climax of that here. The events here are also the focal point of the initial demand of Pharaoh. Remember that, remember Pharaoh back, you know, way back when, that Israel be released so that they could go into the wilderness to sacrifice to their God. Okay, well, this is it. Now, is it a three-day journey? No. You know, can we reconcile that? Not really. But the point is, this is the culmination of that announcement to Pharaoh. Let my son, Israel, you know, God calls Israel his son. Let my son go so that he can go out into the wilderness away from Egypt, away from out from underneath the auspice of the Egyptian gods, so that we there can be a sacrifice. And, you know, the point of today is going to be, you know, looking at the physics of that, because there is a sacrifice going on here. There's a sacrifice called, you know, a peace offering and a sacrifice for sin. And, you know, what, you know, the main thing that I want to look at today is how do the people feel about that? And what's the result of it? Okay, now, we may not be able to get through all of it today, but for sure, you know, we want to concentrate on these first eight verses in Exodus 24 because it basically describes the physics of what's going on. And I think that probably the sacrificial system is very misunderstood in 21st century America. And so let's take a deeper look at it. Let's look at some of the white papers that have been produced over the years by scholars that, you know, have taken a look at, you know, not only, you know, the text from God's people, but also from other cultures in and around God's people. Because, amazingly enough, you know, they really do line up. Some of the things that are said here, it's difficult to understand. What is worshiping from afar? What does that mean? You know, well, I mean, it's not that hard to figure out what the people thought, you know, when they heard something like that. So, that's where we're at. That's where we're going to be. So, let's go ahead and read the text. And then we'll jump in together. So Exodus 24, picking up, starting in verse 1, let me read the first eight verses to begin with. Then he said to Moses, now the he here obviously is God, because God has been talking directly to Moses, talking about the angel of the Lord the last time we were together, those kind of things. So this he is God. So then he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the rulers, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord, and he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. And he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Okay, praise God for his word. Now, before we get to the fact that Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, actually, you know, that's the American way to say those names. Anytime you basically pronounce a name in Hebrew, the inflection, the hard part of the word, the noun, is on the second syllable. You know, we don't do that. You know, in our culture, the hard inflection is always on the first. You know, it's like Susan. You know, that's the way it works. But so this would really be Nadab, okay, and Abihu, you know. So, at any rate, sorry for the little Hebrew spasm there, but every time I look at them, it's like, yeah, that's really not how you should pronounce them. But that's how most Americans know them, Nadab and Abihu. But Nadab, Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel, they're going to go up, and they're going to see God. This is interesting. And they're going to get so close, they're going to see God. And there was under his feet, as it were, pavement of sapphire stone, like a very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. And they beheld God, and they ate and drank. Okay, so there it is. That's what is going to happen. There's going to be a meal. And I want you to think about the Lord's Supper, okay? I want you to think about what it is to go to God's table and what Jesus established with the apostles, you know, in the Gospels, that, you know, we would do this in remembrance because this is the foundation of it. This is the pillars, you know, that hold all that up. So I want you to think about that, you know, as we're talking about these sacrifices, what they do, how the people felt about them. All right? So then, based on that, let's take a look at hold on just a second. Let me get my act together here. Here we go. Let's take a look at what's going on here then. So, Sarna, the commentator that wrote, you know, one of the best commentaries on Exodus, he says this about, you know, setting up this scene. The stipulations of the covenant between God and Israel, the rules and principles that are henceforth to govern Israelite society have been promulgated, have been put together. The climactic scene in the historic covenant drama is about to be enacted. In other words, take a look at this, and this is going to cement for all time this covenant relationship. Okay, this is what we should always think about when we think about the new covenant in the blood of Christ. These are the things we should be thinking about. An elaborate rite of ratification takes place, after which Moses is called upon to ascend Mount Sinai in order to receive the tangible permanent symbol of the covenant, the two stone tablets into which the Decalogue is incised. And so the whole point is that when Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "Hey, God says, let my son go. Go into the desert 3 days' journey to sacrifice to me." It wasn't just a random sort of thing. I mean, this is all planned out. It's very it's very choreographed, and now we're going to see the end of the dance here. You know,
so this is 3 days from the Red Sea.
Well, you know, let's put it this way: it's when Moses went to Pharaoh and said, "We're going to go a 3 day journey." No matter what that actually meant, this is the end of that journey.
Okay.
Is it 3 days? No, it's not 3 days. We've already seen that.
Right.
But the point is, this is the end of that journey. This was what was supposed to happen.
It's actually Pentecost. 50
yeah.
50 days.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if you look at Exodus 19, you'll see it was in the third month, and it goes down to tell you, and they left, and you would do the numbers, and it's actually 50 days.
Okay.
The 3 days was when they crossed the Red Sea.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so mm-hmm. that's first fruits. Mm-hmm. And then Pentecost comes 50 days later.
Okay. That's cool when you think about Jesus being a new Moses, and then you have a new covenant mm-hmm. at Pentecost.
At Pentecost.
Exactly.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it all matches. It all lines up,
yeah.
You know. Yeah, right.
Mike?
Mm-hmm.
I noticed in verse 9, it talks of Aaron and, this group that went up with Moses.
Right.
Yet back in 19, it talks of only one individual going up with him.
Mm-hmm.
Two different times.
What's the difference?
It's the comings and goings. It really is, John. And the thing is, you know, the author here, Moses presumably, is not all that worried about all those little details. Moses has come and gone more than once, okay? Mm-hmm. And so now he's back down, okay? He's roaming around, he's moving around, but now he's back down and they're all together. And now this whole, the culmination of everything is about to take place.
Well, it almost sounds like you get a synopsis in 19, and now we're
getting more detail.
Mm-hmm. It's repeating the same story.
Right, right. It does sound like that, but you know, there's no way to actually tell, because you know, the biblical writer here isn't really all that concerned about those kinds of details. The point is, you know, this is the culmination of the story. So it could be, John,
that
this...
That's probably my problem, because I'd like to have just a story.
Yeah, no, and that's...
Get it all in chronology.
No, the Bible is not a newspaper article saying, and fact check me, John, fact check me. No, that's not what he's trying to do.
So should we be thinking of this as like that first fire descending Sinai event? Or is this a second event?
Yeah, I think second.
Okay.
Uh-huh, I do. I personally, you know... You could argue both ways, but I think personally, yeah, this is, you know, another event.
And it's not Mount Everest.
No, it's not Mount Everest.
Hill.
Yeah, it's just a hill.
Easy.
Yeah, it's not, yeah. You know, just because people in ancient days didn't climb mountains doesn't mean it was hard or it took a long time. They just didn't go up there. Mm-hmm. Nothing good could be obtained from heading up a mountain, you know. You're going to get into territory that you probably don't want to get into, mm-hmm. as far as they're concerned. Okay. So, the interesting thing here is this is actually a lesson too in sacred spaces. All right, because if you notice the mountain again, you know, we've talked about this before, but the mountain is segregated. Okay, it's segregated into sacred spaces, much like, well, actually exactly like the tabernacle is going to have gradations of sacred spaces, and eventually all the way into the temple in Jerusalem. When the temple is standing, it has sacred spaces, gradations of sacred spaces. Some sacred spaces women could be in, other sacred spaces only men. Other sacred spaces, only ordained priests, and then the most sacred of spaces, only the high priest, after certain rituals had been effected. Okay? And so, you know, here we also see that it, you know, Mount Sinai is divided into gradations of access to Yahweh. It's like zones, okay? Exodus 20, remember Exodus 20, 21, the people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was, and that's the way it was supposed to be. And again, you know, we have this idea of worshiping from afar. You know, again, what does that mean? We're gonna get there. We're gonna talk about that. So, yeah. So, and it's those kind of verses that lead me to say that, well, this is a second event. This is another event. That event's happened already, and this is just another event. So now Nadab and Abihu are Aaron's two sons, and you're going to remember that, you know, they're going to be struck down in Leviticus chapter 10 because they offered strange fire to the Lord. In other words, they were doing something in a sacred space that shouldn't have been done, and God killed them. Okay, and so, you know, a lot of times we look at stories like that, and we see Nadab and Abihu here, and we think those kinds of thoughts. And one of the things that we think about when it comes to blood sacrifice and the fact that the blood is thrown on, splashed on the altar. And we're never told that, you know, a bunch of priests come with Lysol bottles at the end and clean it all back up again. You know, we're never told that, right? I mean, you know, once the blood is cast onto the altar, it stays. It's there. You know, it's not, the altar is never cleaned back up again. And, you know, you look at things like this and you think, oh, well, you know, okay, you get out of sync with God and there's going to be a blood splattering. You know, if a detective comes in after a murder and he sees splatter marks on the wall, he knows something violent has taken place here, you know. And, you know, they'll start looking for murder weapons based on these splatter marks, okay? Well, you know, when blood is splattered on the altar, it's like, whoa, something violent happened here. Okay, you get out of sync with God, bad things are going to happen to you. Is that really? Because in 21st century thought, I mean, you'll hear things like that a lot. And is that really what the people are thinking? Is that really what's taking place? And so, you know, we need to look at those sort of things. Sarner says this, 70 elders are mentioned again only in Numbers 11, 16, 24 through 25, and Ezekiel 8, 11. As in Exodus 1, 5, the number 70 has symbolic force expressing totality, comprehensiveness. It represents the entire community of Israel. Something else other than a warning is happening here because of this number 70. You know, we understand that the 70 represents the nations that were abandoned by God at the Tower of Babel to be under the auspice of other gods, and that when 70 and 12 come together in the Exodus story as they're leaving and leaving Egypt and crossing the Red Sea and then coming to this first resting spot, there's 70 palms and 12 springs, and that's representation of completeness. God and his people, his human family are coming back together again. And so, you know, we have these 70 elders, and we have the 12 tribes. And so, you know, Sarna is saying, pay attention to this. These are important numbers. This is an important thing. And, you know, this whole sacrificial system is not necessarily, you know, a warning that you get out of sync with God and, you know, there's going to be splatter marks everywhere. This is more of unity. This is more uniting, you know, God and his people and getting us ready for that. It represents basically, you know, these numbers represent the people in generally. Now, what are they doing? Well, they're worshiping from afar. God is saying, you guys, you know, Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, 70 elders of Israel, there's going to be this worship from afar. And it's interesting. That term is interesting. And you know, until you understand it, you really won't understand what's going on here. Sarna writes this, throughout the ancient Near East, full-length prostration of the body was a conventional gesture expressing unconditional submission and homage to a superior authority. Now think about that for a minute. Yes, in other words, you're prostrate, flat out on the ground before you're a vassal, and you're coming before your superior authority, your suzerain. And how do you worship? Well, that's how you do it. Okay, and so it's really worshiping from afar doesn't really necessarily talk only about distance. Okay, it talks about being prostrate. It talks about bowing low. He goes on to say, the present instruction is to be understood as part of the formal ceremonial attending the ratification of the covenant. So he thinks it's part of, you know, this overall ceremony. It's important that they worship from afar. Okay, it's a part of the ceremony. It's not simply an act of worshipful reverence from afar. This phrase, he says, might be construed to mean that they are to keep their distance from the mountain summit. And he's saying, not really. However, the figurative use of the idiom, and he says that's what it is an idiom, is to prostrate from afar. As far as in letters to royalty from Ugarit, in both the native language and Akkadian, suggesting a recognized diplomatic courtesy on the part of a vassal who makes repeated prostrations, starting at a distance from the suzerain's presence. Jacob's performance in meeting Esau, as told in Genesis 33:3, illustrates this practice. He himself went on ahead and bowed low to the ground seven times until he was near his brother. Okay, so, and we get the idea that, well, you know, he just went down and bowed to his brother seven times. No, what he's doing is he's prostrating himself as he moves closer and closer to his brother. Okay?
Almost like crawling?
Well, you know, it more than likely he's getting up and walking again, but then another prostrate worshipful stance, and then another, and then another. You do it seven times, and the suzerain's going to get the idea, this person is really worshiping me, okay? I mean, as they get closer, they just continue to do this practice. And so Sarna is asserting that this is what's happening, you know?
So the culture of that time, weren't they more used to worshiping prostrate?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there were a lot, I mean, in the ancient Near East, there were suzerain vassal treaties everywhere. You know, I mean, you were, if you were a part of a suzerain vassal treaty, you were either the suzerain or the vassal, one or the other.
Why don't we do that today?
Well, because we're stiff-necked, stubborn, independent United States Americans that say, don't tread on me, you know. Matter of fact, we came to this country so we get rid of kings, okay? And we don't like it when politicians try to put themselves in the position of kingship. We don't like that, you know. So we say, no, you work for us. I pay your salary. You do what we tell you to do, not the other way around, okay? So actually, you know, In as far as America is concerned, the people are the suzerains, and the government is the vassal. Okay, so
that's the way it's supposed to be, but it's not really.
Well, it's not really, but still, I mean, that's the way the Constitution's written.
But when we worship God, you know, in our setting, we don't do prostrates anymore. So. But the knee, you know, it's bending when you pray, you get down on your knees. But maybe at home you should do the prostrate.
I wouldn't disagree with that at all. Yeah.
And I feel we've lost some of that.
Mm-hmm. We're very proud.
Yeah, other religions do doing that.
Oh, absolutely. They certainly do. Yeah.
Other religions still do that.
Mm-hmm.
Other places in other Christian in different countries do it. We're a platform culture, so we don't ever get on the ground.
Right. Also seeing Catholicism.
Yeah. When they ordain priests, they go flat on their face too, like you were saying.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are times where you will go on your face whether you want to or not.
Well, yeah, no, there's definitely those times. Yeah, there's definitely those times. But we are a very proud and stiff-necked people, no question about it. But there will come a day when you see your king, and there won't be anything but jelly in those legs, and you will melt on the floor. Again, you know, verses 3 and 4, we read this. Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, okay? And all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. And he rose early in the morning and he built an altar. We've already been given instructions on how to build that altar, right? We've read about that at the foot of the mountain. And here's the thing, 12 pillars, according to the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, so there's no guessing about what those 12 pillars stand for, right? I mean, that it's real clear. It's real obvious. Those 12 pillars represent the 12 tribes. And so I think this is probably a key point of understanding what's going on here. This is a key point. Because I've often thought, now, you know, I don't know exactly how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of Israelites are here. You know, I don't know how many, but we do know this. There's a bunch, you know, it's much bigger than this crowd. And so, you know, on this crowd, if I were to sprinkle blood on you, I could do it. It would take me a few minutes, but I could get you all, okay? But you put 1 million people, I'd have to have some kind of fire hose, you know, to actually get you all, you know. I just would. And so I've always thought, you know, wait a minute. You know, it says that, you know, that blood was sprinkled on the people. And who would you be if you were in the splash zone? You know, it would be like Nickelodeon, you know, when you get gooped. Okay. But how in the world am I going to get, you know, blood all the way back, you know, 500 feet? You know, you just can't do it. And then so what? You know, you're sitting there as the people of God, and you know, you've got this guy just happy as can be because he's got blood running all over him. I mean, this guy in the back saying, well, I got nothing, you know, what's up with that? You know, what's up with that? So, you know, so what really is going on? That's one of my questions, you know. So, you know, so Moses essentially tells everybody how God wants things to go. How he wants them to run, and they agree. So there's this agreement. God says, here's the rules. The people are saying, okay, we accept those rules. We're fine with that. And Moses records what happens. And apparently the point is that these stipulations and their actions were to become a part of the description of the treaty with Yahweh. In other words, you know, part of the ratification procedure. Just like Sarna alluded to, built an altar. We saw, you know, recently what those rules were. An altar. If you don't remember Exodus 20, verse 24, an altar of earth you shall make for me, and sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings. Okay, so there's going to be two types of offerings, the burnt offerings. Okay, now what happens with the burnt offerings? Well, they're burnt. Okay. And you know, that's not being shared, OK? Okay? They're burnt. Okay? But what's happening with the peace offerings? That's not necessarily all being burnt. You know, there's a meal, you know, that's happening with the peace offering. Okay? So there's two different types of offerings going on, one shared, one not. And remember, the verse goes on, offerings in your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen, in every place where I cause my name. Now, here's this name theology again. Again, you know, there's a struggle here in academia, especially about, you know, what this actually means. But I lean heavily toward the fact that, you know, whenever the name Hashem is talked about in Scripture, you're literally saying, this is God. Okay. I cause my name to be remembered. I will come to you and bless you. So, you know, it's interesting that Moses builds an altar at the foot of the mountain. And that signifies that that is where the name is. You know, you build an altar, the name is there. Hashem, Yahweh, he's there. Okay. And so you don't mess with that. It's an important thing. You don't do it lightly. I will cause.
Isn't that where the 70 people are at, though? The 70?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Is that this altar?
That's at this altar.
So when they don't go up, that's a spirit of the Lord type thing that's at the bottom.
The altar's at the foot of the mountain.
Uh-huh. Yes. Right.
But then after the sprinkling of the blood, then they go up.
Then they all do go up. They 70 do go up to have the meal. Okay. But just remember, where I cause my name to be remembered. That's a very important part of this altar process. Okay. So if we're going to understand it, we've got to understand everything that we've been instructed so far. You know, we can't just take this little piece. You got to remember it all. Really, Heiser puts it this way, name theology is something that should be in the forefront of your mind at all times when it comes to the covenant, okay, because the name of God. Now, there's a reference here to the 12 pillars, all right, and this is something that we really need a good understanding of, because we've seen pillars before. We've seen pillars in Genesis, for instance, Jacob. Okay, what happens when pillars are erected? And basically, this is not something that, you know, you do architecturally. This is not something you take a tool and carve out. This is nothing more than probably getting a very significant stone and getting it up on its end somehow. This is less like Stonehenge, which are monoliths that have been carved out, and much more like, you know, a big rock that's just standing upright. Now, what kind of attributes are assigned to that pillar? First of all, you know, it's always a marking spot, and it's always a spot where you come in contact and make a covenant. There's some kind of covenant that's made when that pillar is erected. And the interesting thing about, you know, the pillars that we see in the Old Testament, they commemorate things. Interesting. Sarna says this. It's likely that the dashing of the blood on the people described in verse 8 was efficated by sprinkling it over the pillars. Okay, not on the people, because it didn't need to be on the people, but it had to be on the pillars. That's how all the people got the blood. Okay, because the pillars stood in the presence of God, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. So if there was blood on all 12 of the pillars, there was blood on every single person in the crowd. Okay? And actually, we should already be thinking this way. Why? Because, okay, so Jacob puts up a pillar, and what's he do? He pours oil on it. He anoints it. He's having this covenant relationship with God. Sometimes pillars are erected between two individuals, like Jacob and Laban. And a pillar is erected, and this covenant is made. And it's made because the pillar hears it. And it's going to stand for all time. The pillar actually has ears. The pillar actually records what's being said. Now, I know that that maybe doesn't set right with your 21st century American mind, but that is the way it is. That's the way it is. And so the pillar, without question, completely and wholly represents the covenant. It just does. It does. In Genesis 31, 45 through 54, an upright pillar, matzavah, that's what the Hebrew word is for pillar, served as a mute witness to a treaty between Jacob and Laban. A large stone was similarly used to commemorate the covenant between God and Israel made at Shechem. The note in Joshua 24, 27 is instructive. See, this very stone shall be a witness against us, for it heard all the words that the Lord spoke to us. So, obviously, stones don't have ears. So the idea is that the stone represents the individuals that did hear everything. It treats it as though it were those actual persons. Okay? And so that's what's going on. And that's how the blood was thrown on all the people. Okay? And, you know, that makes sense, right? It just makes sense. And that's how things are enacted. Because, you know, to be honest with you, it's kind of an unappetizing thought that, you know, blood's going to be cast on everybody. And, well, what would you do then? Well, I'm going to go home and take a bath. Well, no, I'm not going to wash the blood off of me. Why would I do that? That's almost like saying I'm rejecting God. Okay? So you wouldn't even be able to do that. And how would you ever change your clothes if that were the case? Mm-hmm. If I took my clothes off that the blood was sprinkled on, then, you know, I'd be rejecting God. Mm-hmm. But not if the pillar stood in my place and the pillar never had that blood washed off of it. Jesse?
I was just saying it'd be like throwing out your wedding ring.
It'd be like throwing out your wedding ring. Well, that's a good analogy. It would be like, yeah, taking your wedding ring off and tossing it. You would never want to do that. Carpenter writes this: these pillars served as a silent testimony to the covenant and commitment of each tribe to Yahweh and Yahweh's commitment to them. So when the blood was being applied to the pillars, the people were pointing and saying, yes, that's us. That's who we are. We're receiving the blood. Okay? That's just the way it worked.
Because they were used to it.
They were very used to it. Right. They were very used to it.
It's just us that didn't understand.
Right. But again, you know, why else would you erect the pillars? Why would you do that? You know? You wouldn't. If you weren't going to put something on it. Or it wasn't going to represent something. You would never do that. What would be the point? You're not necessarily marking the piece of ground with it. You know, like a landmark, like we do, you know, a boundary marker or something like that. No, it actually represents you. It's you standing there. Okay.
So is the altar representative of God then?
It is.
Like blood's getting thrown on God and the people?
Yes.
So there's that exchanging of vows?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly, Jesse. That's right. So now you're getting it. You know, you're seeing the picture, what's going on, and how the people are feeling about what's going on.
It's a picture of the wedding ceremony.
Yeah, it actually is. That's good, Terry. That's right. Yeah, it's a picture of a wedding ceremony as well. Yeah. So in verse 5, you know, we have references to the sacrifices. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. So there are two types of offerings: burnt offerings, peace offerings. I know I'm reading a lot to you, but this is technical. I mean, this is just technical, and if you don't get the technical part of it, you're not going to understand what's going on. So now, Sarna writes this. The two types of sacrifice are the olah, okay? The olah, that's Hebrew for burnt offering. And the shelamim, okay? Hebrew for peace offering. The latter term, often rendered peace offerings, is more accurately an offering of well-being or a sacrifice of greeting. Okay,
that's what?
The peace offering is more accurately an offering of well-being or a sacrifice of greeting.
Greeting,
yes. You can go back to Leviticus and you'll get some of that language there. You know, you can or go forward actually to Leviticus. You'll get a good flavor of that. The first, the olah, was wholly consumed by fire upon the altar. The second was shared, okay? Certain parts being burnt and the rest consumed by the worshiper. The sacrifice of the shemalim was a kind of shared sacred meal, okay? And that's going to become interesting in verse 11, you know, as we get there, because that's exactly what they're doing. They're sharing a meal. So verses 6 through 8, what's done with the blood was drawn, in scholarship has always drawn a lot of interest. It's always drawn a lot of debate, you know, what about this blood? So we have here Moses, he takes half of the blood, puts it in the basins, half of the blood he throws against the altar. So half is gone by the time he gets to verse 7, and we look at the book of the covenant, and he reads in the hearing of the people, and then in verse 8, and Moses took the blood, okay, the rest of it, the other half, and he threw it on the people, okay, again, most likely the standing stones that represent the people, and said, behold the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. So the fact that the blood is divided up into basins and two different things are done with them, you know, that's what draws the interest, because obviously it's a ceremony and it's a little bit unusual. It's one of only three passages where the blood is said to be applied to the people in any sense, even if pillars are meant, and the division of the blood, it's just unusual. Why is he doing this? What are the thoughts that the people, the ancient readers, have? Well, Sarna writes a lot about that. Again, I do apologize for reading to you, but, I mean, again, this is technical. You need to understand this. The blood of the olah and the shemalim was always collected and dashed against the sides of the altar, all the other instances he's saying. In the present ceremony, Moses performs this standard ritual with only half of the blood. He stored the other half in basins for later sprinkling on the people. The two parts were for the two parties of the covenant, God and Israel, respectively. Okay? The significance of the sprinkling of the blood is never explained. However, the prevailing notion in Israel was that the blood, the vital bodily fluid, constituted the life force. As such, like life itself, it belonged to God alone. For that reason, its consumption by humans is strictly forbidden. You know, that's the whole point of being kosher, right? I mean, you make sure that the life force, the life blood, is not in any of the meat that you consume. You just can't do that. Why? Because it does represent life. You know, you can't mess with it. You can't eat it. You can't consume it, because it's the life force that, you know, comes from the animal. The use of blood in a covenant is found nowhere else in the Bible. The ordination of Aaron as high priest, as related in Exodus or Leviticus 8, involved daubing the blood of the sacrificial lamb of ordination on parts of his body and on the altar. It is likely that in both these ceremonies, covenant and ordination, the blood functions mysteriously to cement the bond between the involved parties. Through God's sharing, it is, as it were, of the vital fluid with Israel or with Aaron, the life of the recipient is thought to take a new dimension and to be elevated to a higher level of intimate relationship with the deity. Okay.
Well, precursor for Christ's blood.
Communion, I thought about.
Correct.
Communion?
Correct.
Yeah, because at first right. It's on you, and then in the new covenant, it's in you.
It's in you. That's right. Exactly, Jesse. That's right. And so this is how the people are feeling. You know, they're already understanding that the blood, the importance of the blood is the life force. And when part of it is sprinkled, splashed on the altar, and the name theology says the altar is Yahweh, he's getting the blood, okay? And the pillars representing you is getting the blood, and now that is bringing you into a higher communal relationship. That's what the people were experiencing. That's what they were seeing. Okay. And so what they were confident of is now we can have a meal with God.
Say that again.
What they were confident of through the whole experience of seeing the blood on the altar on themselves is now we have this new covenant, higher elevated covenant relationship. Now we can have a meal with God. Now we can sit at his table. Now we can share sustenance.
So even from the very beginning, he's always been inviting us to his table.
Yes.
From the very beginning. It's just that, how come we don't get it?
Well, because most of the time, we love to look at Jesus as our best friend, and that no matter who we are or how we feel about him, he's completely accepting of us, completely and totally, head over heels in love with us that, you know, we need do nothing to sit in his presence. You know, too often we have that understanding, and that's not the proper understanding. It's his blood, you know, it's his blood that makes us able to have fellowship with him, to sit at that table. That's the reason why the blood is a part of the
communion.
Of the communion.
Yeah, but even the Old Testament, though, I mean, like other churches, when they teach about the Old Testament, it never goes there.
No.
You know what I mean? So I guess what I'm trying to say, even in the Old Testament from the very beginning, he's been inviting us all this time, and then he did it again in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, so it's always been there. It's just that we didn't know about it in the Old Testament. We only learn about it in the New Testament. That's
right.
When they're more prevalent. There's more teaching, you know, about the communion versus.
Yes.
You know,
I know exactly what you're saying. And not having this kind of background in the Old Testament and basically never having it taught, I don't know how you truly understand the depths of communion, the depths of the Lord's Supper. I just don't see how you understand it. You know, I really don't. So I agree with you. and then, you know, Sarna, I'm not going to read all of it to you, but I did want to read one last thing that he has to say. He says this, the blood remaining on the altar is a visible reminder of the performance of sacrifice and its corresponding blessing, which is the establishment of the covenant relationship.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Terry.
So in the New Testament, when we're taught about the blood of Christ cleanses you,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
here, with the burnt offering and the blood and being sprinkled, did they understand that that was a cleansing? Was there for
yeah
Israel
no yeah
sprinkling?
It wouldn't have. I don't think anybody would have disagreed with you if you would have said, well, we just got cleansed. I don't mm-hmm. think anybody would push back on that.
Do they have that thinking though? Is that mm-hmm. what they
oh yeah, well, that's the thing. Yeah. They have that thinking. We don't, but they had that thinking. They knew what was going on.
But it's not cleansing from sin.
No.
Okay.
No.
We think of the blood, the New Testament, that we're being cleansed from sin.
No.
But Leviticus teaches the blood sacrifice is the blood purified sacred space.
Right.
Okay. It made you in this place sacred so that you could commune with God. Mm-hmm. There was no atonement for sin in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that many times.
Right. Right.
So what this is doing, this is making the people sacred space, the altar sacred space, so that they could come together,
right,
and work in and commune together.
Just
in
like
this
the temples,
feast.
Just now, yeah, to do with the temple, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so you, yeah, and so every time they sacrificed at the temple and they sprinkled blood, they were purifying sacred space. Now you take that fast forward to what Jesus did, and it just should blow your mind, because now there's atonement for sin that Old Testament never had. Mm. Now there's atonement for sin. Now when they hear what Jesus did, they go, "You mean I'm no longer guilty? I can be, you know, I'm free. I'm atoned for." But at the same time, when that blood comes in me, you know, and washes me, cleanses, purifies me, now my body is sacred space. And God can dwell in me.
Because the body is because we're the temple of God.
Yeah. Amen. That takes communion to a much higher level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, so you put those two things together, what's happening here in this marriage ceremony, because if you guys were here when I taught the Jewish wedding, you know this is the marriage ceremony.
Yeah.
This was the exchanging the vows and the feast. This is, and then you go forward and you look at communion and what Jesus did. And you look at all, I mean, we're talking about they became sacred space, we are sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
God dwells.
This is purely God in the cloud. This isn't a direct meal with him, other than the presence of the
He's
cloud
there.
And the fire, right?
It's a divine council scene.
Yeah, it's a divine council scene. That's
They're
right.
seeing him.
Yeah, they are.
Put Moses in the cleft of the rock, let him go by and send over. Mm-hmm.
But the angel of the Lord is there.
Yeah, they can see him.
They can see him.
Okay. Him
the
they
pre-incarnate
can.
So Jesus is so, there.
Right. And again, this is God as man in the Old Testament, you know. And you know, if truly, I say this probably too much, but, you know, we try to take this and we try to relegate it to Jesus of the New Testament and pull Jesus of the New Testament back somehow to say this kind of like is symbolic of him. No, you know, you leave new Jesus in the New Testament, you know, you leave the incarnate Christ after the birth in the New Testament. That's where he belongs. He does not belong back here because he's already here. He's here already. He's the angel of the Lord. And so never bring him back.
It is him. Yeah.
No, it is him.
They are seeing him.
Yeah, they are seeing him. Right.
No wonder they're prostrate.
Yeah, I like the way
he's up here, right? Like standing over them on some
level. Yeah, yeah. They're actually looking up at his feet. But the point is, I like the way Sheila teaches that, you know, Adam and Eve would have never hidden behind a tree from the Spirit of God. They would have never had the concept of hiding from him. It was the angel of the Lord they were hiding from. He was a man. And they were actually, they knew that he had a physical being and eyes. And I can hide behind a tree and he can't see me. You know, they got that. They knew that. They were used to walking with him. Wasn't just a spirit floating around everywhere. Why in the world would you have a concept of hiding from that? That would be dumb. You know, so, all right. So, now, how do we kind of, gosh, how do we sum all this up? I'm not sure that I want to go into any more detail about that. There's a lot more detail, actually. But, you know, just remember that, you know, kind of summing things up, there are those who say the ritual is cultic. It's an event that seals the covenant between God and the congregation. Certainly does. There are those who emphasize it's probably also a sanctifying or purifying act. It does create sacred space, no question about that. there's a third category, a guy named Heiber. He quotes it pretty well, is that the blood signifies that the people's blood would be shed if they were to break the covenant. Again, you know, that's not necessarily the central focus. There's no question, though, that a covenant, cutting a covenant, said that, you know, if I don't uphold my end of the covenant, may what's happened to this animal happen to me. No question that that is a small part of it, but just remember that, you know, we are talking about creating a sacred space. It happens ritualistically. It's a ritual. It's an event that happens, and it's a ritual. But the sacred space, nonetheless, is created. This comes from a scholar who wrote about, you know, this particular event, and she says this: the accompanying peace offering involved the congregation more directly in the sacrificial worship. Once the animal was killed, the blood applied to the altar, the fat burned in the offering to God. The people were allowed to eat the meat of the sacrifice. The primary motivation of this offering was to rejoice. Okay? And that's the reason why when we sit down at the Lord's table, it's not a solemn event. It's an event to rejoice. It's an event to be happy in. It's an event to celebrate, because and that's what was happening here. It's again, the significance of even the word means well-being that existed between God and his people. Not that they communed together, no meat was offered to God, but that all the people rejoiced and celebrated before the Lord. Even here, the blood rite is clearly the quintessential element in the well-being offering. It prepares for and makes possible the subsequent celebration in God's presence. In sum, in the sacrificial system, blood atoned both the place of offering and the people so that the gifts could be safely given to God and so that celebration could take place with him. By mentioning these specific offerings in Exodus 24, the reader expects similar results. There you have it. So that's what it's really all about. Now, here's one last thing that, you know, I want to talk about as far as these pillars are concerned, because this is an interesting thing. We find this language scattered through Scripture, and it's not only talking about representing people. It's actually talking about actual individuals. Now, here's something that doesn't set well if you are just so bent on the sovereignty of God that you can't see straight. There are times that basically, you know, just like the announcement of the name, I am that I am, there are times that say, you know, this is who I am because of who I am. Okay? And people that's really bent heavy on the sovereignty of God, that's the only place they want to go. But don't forget that sometimes God is, how do I want to say this? Sometimes God is represented to the people by those who he's associated with. Okay, because he's the God of, you guessed it, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God, what makes you a big deal? What gives you the credentials to say that I should worship you? Well, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Oh, that's good credentials. Okay, so, and this has a lot to do with pillars. And you might think that this is kind of like getting off subject, but it's interesting because even in Paul's writings, people were considered pillars. Listen to Galatians 2:9 here. You know, this is Paul writing about just the whole structure of the church and who was going to go to the Jews and who was going to go to the Gentiles. Okay, listen to this. This is Galatians 2:9. And when James and Cephas and John, okay, so now here's James, Peter, and John, okay, they're three, right? I mean, so we have this understanding as we read the New Testament, we have this understanding that there's 12 apostles who, okay, yeah, they mirror the 12 tribes. Because when we move forward into the gates and the foundation of the new city, the new Jerusalem in Revelation, we see that, you know, there the names of the 12 tribes are on the foundation and the names of the 12 apostles are on the doors, okay? Like, okay, so that mirrors them, that ties them tightly together. But, you know, there's also the inner circle, the three that are set apart, that are different than the others, okay? James and Peter and John. And so what's that all about? We'll listen again to Galatians 2:9. And when James and Cephas and John, Cephas being Peter, who seem to be pillars, okay, perceived the grace that was given to me, they gave the right hand of fellowship to Barnabas and me. They had some kind of credentials that allowed them to say, okay, you know, Paul and Barnabas are going to go to the uncircumcised while we stay with the circumcised. But, you know, they gave them their creds. They had street cred because of these three pillars. God has street cred because of three pillars. And so did Paul and so did Barnabas, that we should go to the Gentiles and they would stay with the circumcised. Now, you know, you as you look at this, you would say, well, that's odd. Why did he call them pillars? Well, because it's always been a part of the people of God thinking that, okay, the pillars that give God his credentials are the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God introduces himself over and over and over again to everyone who wants his credentials. Who are you? I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Oh, okay, well, those are good credentials. You know, I so you're something. You know, if you're their God, you're something. And a lot of times, you know, we don't like that because it's like, well, God doesn't have to explain himself to anybody. Well, but he does. He does. No, he doesn't have to. You're right. But he does. And so, you know, pillars have always been a part of communal life with God. Okay. So James and Peter and John represent for the church the exact same thing that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob represented for Israel. And so you can never say that the church is usurping Israel or vice versa, because they're both structured the same and this ties them together.
We always have a saying of the pillars of the church.
Yeah. Still use that, right.
But this really puts a different light on everything. I think that if we are in a church, we had to be careful who we put that there as a pillar.
Yes.
You know?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
We should use these as examples. You know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and mm-hmm. James, Peter, and John. Do they have these qualities?
Right. And remember, the three pillars of Israel is more important than the 12, because the 12 came out of the three.
Say that again.
The three pillars of Israel is more important than the 12 tribes, because the 12 came out of the three.
Okay.
And so, you know, we go back to those three pillars again in the church. Again, sorry, one last reading here. In both the latter, these references, to the New Jerusalem that I was talking about, the motif of pillars plays an important role. At the outset of his public ministry, Jesus chooses 12 disciples, a reconstitution of the 12 tribes of Israel. And at the Last Supper, he inaugurated a new covenant with the 12, indicating a new Israel. In the covenant ratification ceremony of Exodus 24, Moses, at the foot of Mount Sinai, erected 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes. Then he threw blood of the covenant upon the people of Israel, since in rabbinic sources, the Messiah is often viewed as the final redeemer, the first being Moses. The connection between Moses' 12 pillars and the blood of the covenant and Jesus, the Messiah, and the 12 disciples and the blood of the new covenant is striking. So, and he goes on, he talks about Revelation 21, 12, the gates of the holy city, the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven in the eschatological age. On those gates, the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel are inscribed. Revelation 5:14 states that the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb were on the 12 foundations of the wall. Here, the 12 disciples of Jesus support the new Israel, the Christian church. They function as a foundation, a term parallel to and at times interchangeable with pillars. And so he goes on to suggest, I won't read you anymore, but he goes on to suggest that Galatians 2:9, out of this singling out Peter, James, and John, are linking and identifying exactly the same way. And so it's no different. It's no different. We should look at Peter, James, and John the same way that Israel looks at Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And oftentimes that doesn't sit well in American church. Again, we don't like icons. Okay, so again, I know this might have been a little bit of a snooze fest for you, but the point here is if you don't understand what's going on, the mechanism that's happening here, you're not going to get this covenant relationship that we're in. These are the pillars. These are the foundation for the relationship you have with Jesus Christ in his blood right now.
Okay.
And your sacred spaces. That's right. Yes. Okay. Any questions about that?
I think Sheila was going to share something with us.
Go ahead.
I'm going to give a preview because we're going to start into the tabernacle soon and building it and incorporating study I read on Leviticus. So there's three basic sacrifices that are offered daily. And we have two of them right here. Okay? The first one and the last one. He talked to you about the burnt offering, then there's the grain offering, and then there's the peace offering. Fellowship offering is here. Anyway, here's how it was summarized in Leviticus study. The burnt offering is like knocking on the door saying, I want to spend time with God. And they did that first thing every morning. And the entire animal was burned up because it was all about, I want to be with God. So that's the first thought of your day. I'm going to be with God. They would have smelled that sacrifice all through the camp. I want to be with God. The grain offering was saying, I am reminded of our binding relationship, our covenant, what we just saw happen. We just saw the covenant being made. Okay, so the grain offering, and it was grain that was brought. The fistful was given to God, and all the rest was the priesthood. It belonged to the priesthood, separated them a little bit. But the peace offering says where they all feasted together. That offering was for all of them to feast together on. And that happened regularly. It said, all is well. And he's grateful. We're grateful that all is well. So that's a summary of the main three come. And that's why when Jesus goes in and he gets rid of the money changers and all that at the temple and he cleanses his temple, what did he say? My house is not a house of atonement. My house is a house of prayer. The tabernacle is all about sacred space to commune with God. It's like bringing a housewarming gift every morning. As you would visit someone's new house, you bring a housewarming gift and you say, I'm here to commune.
That's so good.
That's what it's about. Every single day. So that's where we go with the building of the tabernacle and the sacrifices.
I never thought about sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about sacred space. Now we can commune together, feast together.
All right, that's a perfect way to end this lesson. So we'll pick up again the next time we're together, whenever that is.